Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies China Energy Program. I'm Anders Hovey, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Mikhail Maidan, who is the Director of the China Program at OIES and Senior Research Fellow, and Philip Andrew Speed, who is also a Senior Research Fellow at the Institute in the China Energy Program. Today, we are talking about the just completed two sessions of the Chinese National People's Congress and what this two sessions this year in 2023 means for energy. And we are recording this on March 23rd, 2023, so bear that in mind as regards news flow about the China energy sector. So to get us started on this topic of the two sessions, I'd like to start out with the basics. Mikhail, could you just tell us what are the two sessions? What do they usually do? What should we expect to learn from the two sessions?
So every March, every year, China's parliament, the National People's Congress, and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, which is an advisory body, hold their annual meetings in Beijing. So there are two meetings, hence the name, two sessions. For this occasion, we have thousands of delegates from China's provinces, businesses, ministries, but also celebrities that descend on Beijing for the sort of 2 weeks during which this is held. Now, the attendance is also usually significant because it tells us about sort of who's hot and who's not. This year, for instance, we didn't get many of the tech giants that were around in previous two sessions, but actually got a lot of chip makers that were around. So it's the event, it's sort of what is discussed by the parliament, but also what happens at the sidelines that we watch, because there's a lot of sort of chatter around the two sessions, which are sort of lobbying attempts. But to the sessions themselves, they are obviously the main event. That's when the State Council, so China's government, the National Development and Reform Commission, which is the biggest and most influential ministry in China, as well as the Ministry of Finance, give their work reports. They talk about what China has accomplished, but also give their guidance for the year ahead. And during the two sessions, the parliament ratifies legislation, personnel changes, government reorganization, and of course, the government budget. Once every 5 years, on top of that, we get a leadership change. So the parliament also ratifies a new cabinet and any sort of bigger ministerial reorganization. This year we had one of those changeovers because effectively this is the second part of the leadership transition. We talked about the party changeover in October. So now that's sort of filtering through to the government. That's kind of the theatrics and the big event of the two sessions.
Right. And maybe could you help us with some of the highest level macro takeaways from the two sessions where we would expect to learn something about the economy and something about the plans for this year? What for you were some of those big macro takeaways?
So the two sessions are very broad and comprehensive because they touch on all aspects of Chinese kind of macroeconomic, but policies and politics. But if we think about energy demand more narrowly, and we'll talk about energy policies perhaps a bit later, then really it's the macroeconomic targets that we're looking at because they tell us what the government is thinking or signaling about growth potential and economic activity. And of course, energy demand is very closely linked to that economic activity. So what the government did this year was set a GDP growth target of around 5%. That's seen by many as conservative. In the run-up to the two sessions, there was a lot of press reporting and analyst notes that were talking about closer to 6% GDP growth target. So this is deemed quite conservative. And just to remind that last year's GDP growth came in at 3%. So an upside from last year. But the work report really highlighted the risks and challenges that China faces both internally and internationally, which I think explains some of the caution in the GDP growth targets. At the same time, this is also a new government that's coming in. Now, the work report was given by Li Keqiang, the outgoing premier. But of course, it was done in coordination and consultation with Li Qiang, the incoming premier. But any new leadership, one could argue that they would prefer to give a more cautious target that they would overachieve rather than underwhelm. We are on the side of sort of the people who think that overachieving might be challenging this year, because some of the fiscal and monetary targets are not hugely loose. There's a new financial regulator that's been created as part of the government overhaul, which is widely expected to crack down on financial risk. And a lot of that financial risk is in local governments. So not a huge amount of room for local governments to engage in a massive fiscal stimulus. And part of the sense that I got, at least, was that really the government is hoping to achieve this around 5% growth target by walking back restrictions, the zero COVID restrictions, but perhaps more importantly, the restrictions on the real estate sector, on private enterprise and technology, because really that would help drive consumption and do the heavy lifting that China needs for its growth, because there has been this long-standing agenda of trying to move away from industrial activity, infrastructure spend, and more to a consumption-driven sort of economic growth style. So to bring that back to kind of the nuts and bolts of energy demand, we are facing a strong year in terms of economic activity. But the question is, where will that 5% come from? So the government wants consumption. Localities tend to focus on infrastructure project, again, if they can, on real estate and roads and bridges. And in energy terms, that looks different, right? If we get more mobility and more consumption, that's oil demand on the lighter end of the barrel. There's some more gas consumption from industrial activity. But you get more coal consumption, for instance, if you have heavy industry. And that, you know, even some of the Chinese consultancies are not expecting a huge uptick in coal demand this year. So really, we have a little bit of certainty on where the government wants to go. But equally, for me, lots of open questions. So when looking at that, and maybe I'll start with my observations, Philip, what stood out to you in this year's two sessions?
Well, Mikhail, I think one thing that stood out is the persistent policy tension between the state and the market. I mean, many of you will recall big reforms happening between 1998 and 2003, and they stalled. And then early documents in the Xi Jinping regime emphasized the role of markets in setting prices. But of course, as we know, the energy sector is still governed mainly by plans and targets. I mean, the power sector, there were in 2015, there were policy documents picking up where 2003 left off. But today, power prices are still controlled within a limited band. And some 80% of power is still traded on medium and long-term contracts rather than on spot markets. In natural gas, yes, the creation of Pipe China has increased access to pipelines by companies other than the big NOCs. The national carbon market, it exists, there is trading, but it's for thermal power stations only, allocations based on emissions intensity. There's low liquidity, fraudulent reporting, and other problems. So that isn't going very far, very fast. And if we look at the work reports published in March 2023, we see some rather curious phrases. Enable the market to play a decisive role in resource allocation, which sounds good, but then it says give full play to the role of government and promote better combination of effective market and an effective government. So that really is telling us that this tension between the state and the market and the ambiguity persists. But what do you think all this means, Anders?
Yeah, I agree with that. New phrasing around giving a full play to government policy is a significant indication that perhaps the priority this year, at least, is not to expand the role of the market in giving price signals or directing investment. And, you know, that's one of the themes that I've been recently writing about, which is the understanding of the market as a more of a short-term tweak as opposed to something that would really play a very major role in guiding investment. And I think this year's two sessions documents really do seem to be in that direction where, as you said, administrative planning is probably key. In addition, I think that it's interesting to think about the role of renewables in the reports that were coming out. I think that in terms of what was mentioned in the speeches by some of the participants, renewables did not seem very prominent. And mentions of coal seemed more prominent, which is certainly in keeping with what we've been hearing for the last year or so related to energy security. In terms of talking about renewables, there was relatively more touting of the achievements of renewable installations last year, as opposed to setting aggressive targets for this year. But nevertheless, there is a pretty big target, 165 gigawatts combined wind and solar for this year, which would be significantly more than last year. And these reports generally put the emphasis on the large-scale wind and solar bases. These are in the desert areas of Inner Mongolia and Western China. And I think that that's interesting because, of course, those clean energy bases, although they're emphasizing the clean energy, actually a lot of the energy production would come from coal plants that are located on those bases as well. So that's interesting to see that that is clearly the emphasis, not on kind of market drivers of distributed renewables or provincial installations of renewables outside of those big energy bases. So that's, for me, those were some of the takeaways. And Mikhail, I know that you did the word count analysis and you showed in general that the word counts for things like energy security, renewables, markets, proportionally, they were broadly similar, I thought, to last year. But it does seem that the overall subtext does have a lot more emphasis on the energy security topic, which makes me wonder, you know, what's your interpretation of how people in China understand energy security right now? How is it being defined and discussed? And how is that different from what people outside of China typically think of in terms of energy security?
I mean, the word count was a fascinating exercise, and economy came up dramatically more times this year than last year, as did market. So there are a few sort of oxymorons. Energy security, certainly higher in the word count, as was coal. But renewables, there was also more about renewables and more about reform. But clearly, again, it's economic growth, it's stability, security. And one of the other threads that was very visible in the work reports was this assessment that the US is looking to suppress and contain China. So again, if we're talking about tensions, on one hand, a view that the economy needs to be self-reliant and look inward, but at the same time, a recognition that China still needs foreign inputs and foreign imports, mainly of technologies and others. So on one hand, sending the signal that China is open to business, but equally that it is preparing to be much more self-sufficient. Now, energy security, I think for many years in China, much of the discussion was about mitigating the vulnerabilities associated with oil and gas imports. There have been people advocating for more demand-side measures, for energy efficiencies, for price reforms. And, you know, if we look back at it, then the insecurity or the instances where China has suffered energy outages have actually come from domestic policies, right? Mismatches between international prices, domestic prices, rather than any curtailment of flows from the West or from sort of international markets. I think the only caveat to that is that US financial sanctions and secondary sanctions on Iran, on Venezuela, on Chinese shippers have complicated flows, but they haven't led to outages. So the focus, I think, historically has very much been on the kind of vulnerabilities, external vulnerabilities. And with this assessment that the US is out to contain and suppress China, that I think has been reinforced. And again, this sort of inward-looking narrative. So clearly, coal can provide security and reliability. And as you noted, you know, renewables were absent from that, even though last year they were a little bit of, there was more talk about renewables being able to provide China with more security because it is a kind of homegrown technology and resource. That doesn't seem to have been that prominent this year. So the kind of broad conversation this year is pretty much an all of the above approach. Now, when we look at it from the outside, I think Western observers tend to pick and choose what suits their China narrative best, you know, when focusing on the energy security dimensions. But this year, it felt like very much an all of the above approach, talk about nuclear, again, about renewables. One interesting exception was less coal to gas switching, which the kind of government said, we will strictly control the expansion of projects to replace coal with natural gas and ensure the steady supply of natural gas. So this is sort of alluding to the fact that international markets are volatile, that China doesn't want to be caught short or just having to pay high prices. So strictly controlling means limiting new coal to gas switching. But that doesn't mean, I think, that China will stop importing gas. Again, we look at these documents for general direction of travel. I think we shouldn't overread how prescriptive they are. They give guidance, but there are also obviously different policy objectives. Security imperative is huge, but there is also, we talked about the word market being used, a market liberalization sort of policy strand that might not be as elevated this year, but still exists, right? The government is looking to open up the market, to introduce new sectors into gas. And that means that we will get more imports, right? In China, and it's still a growing market in China. So I think we have to be a bit careful about overstating that energy security means a return to coal and no more gas. The reality is that there are policy tensions, a bit like the ones Philip discussed, that means that it's we get a bit of everything. But just a final note on this energy security point, I think it's being expanded. There's clearly a focus on domestic production of oil and gas. But this year's report also talks about critical materials. It says explicitly we will support domestic exploitation of resources such as iron ore, potassium, and lithium, as well as oil and natural gas, which, again, I think is an interesting inclusion. But that actually leads me to a question to you, Anders. How are you seeing kind of this energy security imperative in, I guess, the broader EV supply chain?
Yeah, I think that that inclusion of lithium is particularly interesting in that list. And it highlights one of the paradoxes globally is that as Europe and the United States and other countries are seeking to ensure that they are not wholly reliant on China and the Chinese manufacturers, as well as Chinese supplies of some critical materials, that that to some extent, China perceives this as a challenge and a threat to its own position, as well as potentially to its own security of supply for critical energy-related materials. So I think it was very interesting to see that the head of CATL, which is the world's largest battery manufacturer, put forward a proposal for increasing the supply of lithium and securing the supply of lithium for China. And he, in his proposal, he emphasized many of the aspects relate to the bottlenecks within China for just shipping lithium and battery materials around the country and getting them to where they need to be for the manufacturing of batteries. So I think it's interesting to see that, and I think the same thing is true on rare earths, where China has this incredibly dominant position on rare earths in terms of processing. But nevertheless, even though other countries perceive that as somewhat of a threatening dominance by China, that China perceives any loosening of that dominance as somewhat risky for itself as well. And I think that the same thing is also true perhaps in the solar industry, where we've seen China attempting to clamp down on exports and sharing of technologies in terms of polysilicon, which is where basically all of the supply is coming from China. So yeah, that's my my summary of that point.
I mean, I think it's interesting that there's a huge focus right on the supply side of critical materials, of oil. What do you make about the, I guess, demand side from two perspectives? We'll talk about energy conservation in a minute, but there's the technology side of things, right? The ability to create new end uses. That dovetails with the revamp of the Ministry of Science and Technology under a new party commission that will oversee it. So clearly an attempt to try and better control and better coordinate technological innovation and development. How do you see that playing out in the kind of critical materials, new energy side of things, and how will that impact the demand side?
Yeah, I think that it's, you know, clearly China is dominant in many of the fields of clean energy technology. And I think that there are efforts to make sure that China retains that dominance, not just in terms of the supply chain, but also in terms of the technology leadership. And I think that a lot of times people outside of China don't necessarily see China as innovative in these fields, which I think in reality, the innovation platforms that exist in China are actually quite strong. But there's a question about whether they can remain strong if China does continue to seek to do more of a domestic, inward-looking innovation approach, which is led more by the state-owned enterprises as opposed through international cooperation networks. On the demand side as well, you know, we've written in the past that there's a little bit less emphasis on innovation on the demand side. And that is particularly interesting this year for the energy sector, because the head of the National Energy Administration, Zhang Jianhua, put forward a proposal that really on the demand side, there should be much more focus on not just innovation, but just using the market to drive energy saving and treating energy saving as its own form of energy supply. And that's something that has been very hard. China has many times missed targets related to the demand side in various areas, such as, clean heating and other fields where there have been targets, whereas on the supply side in the energy field, often the targets are met. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch whether there are some new targets being put forward there, or if that proposal it remains sort of an aspirational goal.
I mean, if we look at the history, I mean, we go back to 2004 when they introduced this 1,000 enterprises program and gave the big enterprises targets to reduce energy intensity. That worked. But as soon as they expanded it 5 years later to the top 10,000 enterprises, then, although it was 16,000 enterprises in the end, that didn't work nearly so well. So, yes, I think the leader of the NEA is right. They have to put prices such that people are forced to save energy across the economy.
And it's interesting that we're getting this constant tension, right, between how much the government can guide with administrative measures, and we've talked about this on numerous occasions, and how much they let, you know, the market determine certain outcomes. But another thing that came out from the kind of chatter at the sidelines, or the lobbying at the sidelines, mainly I think from Sinopec, was the importance of CCUS. And obviously, if coal is going to play a dominant role, which it is likely to, but also in coal to chemicals and other fields, there is a need for China to develop carbon capture and storage, or carbon capture utilization and storage. And again, this was something that Sinopec, so one of the biggest the biggest refiner in China, was pushing forward. Philip, you've looked at CCS and CCUS in China. What do you make of those comments and of China's aspirations in that field?
Well, the last 10 years or so have seen a number of small carbon capture projects in China of different types from different sources. Many of the bigger ones have deployed this in enhanced oil recovery. And I think one of the reasons why Sinopec was so active at the two sessions was because last August, they commissioned China's first really large facility, 1 million tons of carbon dioxide a year in the Shengli oil field to be used in enhanced oil recovery. The next plant to come online will be from Huaneng, and that will be a true carbon capture from a thermal power station and geological storage. But this is a very slow story compared to the rapid growth of coal-fired power stations that is going on. So I think it's going to be decades, if ever, that it catches up.
Yeah, I think that if I could just add on the demand side, you know, the a question that we get on occasion is whether the carbon market could start to really ramp up and provide the incentive either for CCUS or for, you know, promoting low carbon industry and low carbon technologies. And of course, as long as the carbon market as it exists today, which is an intensity-based market, and it's only applied to coal power generators or thermal generators, that's not likely to result in major new investment in low carbon technologies. But I think that in this two sessions, the carbon markets really kind of dropped out of a lot of the discussion. Both the NDRC report and also the overall work report had a lot less discussion of carbon markets. And I think that it is reasonable to take that as a signal that we shouldn't expect major new developments on carbon prices to accomplish anything specifically on the demand side. One exception might be that clean energy might be allowed to provide provinces and SOEs with an access to excess consumption beyond their so-called dual control energy targets. But other than that, the carbon markets don't seem to be developing with the rapidity that we might have anticipated. And I think even if the carbon markets do, let's say, expand to a new sector in the next year or so, that wouldn't necessarily imply that they will take on a more effective role in guiding investment, such as through higher carbon prices. Mikhail, what is your thought about whether the two sessions overall, we talked about the macro, we talked about economic growth, is this overall bullish or bearish for oil and gas demand?
I think overall it's a bullish signal. To the extent that we're going to get 5% growth and maybe a little bit more, again, we're not hugely optimistic on the ability to outperform, but this is a stronger year than last year. So it's bullish for oil. And on our numbers, we have Chinese oil demand growing by around 700,000 barrels a day, which I think is lower than a lot of the consensus, which has it at closer to 1 million barrels a day. And we are quite bullish on gas demand growth again this year as industry recovers, as there's more residential, sort of ongoing increases in residential growth. On our balances, again, we have 30 BCM of incremental gas demand, although maybe a third of that comes from LNG as there's more domestic production and pipeline imports to meet that demand. But overall, a strong year for the kind of commodity space. So again, that's bullish for the commodity space. Is it really good for China's energy transition? That's a different question. But some of the things that we'll be watching out for, we'll be looking, first of all, at how strong growth will be. So maybe oil demand growth will be stronger than we anticipate. That will, again, depend on what I was talking about earlier, the kind of consumption, the kind of growth that we get. Is it more mobility and end user consumption? Or do we get a lot of big infrastructure projects that will boost not just the kind of middle distillates, but also gas and mainly coal consumption and heavy industry? So we'll be looking to see, tracking again the kind of growth that we get. But equally for oil, we'll be looking at new refining approval and how many refineries are shut down, because that is part of China's pledge to reduce its emissions than it is to peak emissions in refining and chemicals. So we'll have to see how that plays out through the year. So again, just to say that what is bullish for oil and gas markets might not necessarily be as good news for emissions. And with that, let me turn the question to you. We'll start with maybe you, Anders, on sort of what do you think all this means for the 30-60 targets? Is it bullish or bearish for China's ability to reach to peak emissions before 2030 and reach net zero by 2060?
Yes. Well, for now, I am still sticking to my story that China is on track for achieving its carbon peaking and carbon neutrality goals based on the present rate of installations of wind and solar, and that the wind and solar that China is installing will continue to grow, perhaps modestly, perhaps more than modestly, and that these renewable energy sources will be used, and that will ultimately help bring China eventually, gradually, to carbon peaking and carbon neutrality. So does that mean that the new additions of coal and the emphasis on energy security are just noise and it doesn't matter? I don't think so. I think my nuance is that the more coal and the more emphasis on coal does create more capacity for coal. And ultimately, that probably does slow the energy transition and creates, it somewhat squeezes the space for renewables. And therefore, it does tend to limit the possibility that China would enhance its ambitions on climate change. And overall, it does sort of increase the area under the curve, let's say, of China's emissions curve over the next 40 years, because the new plants that are being built will be utilized as well. Maybe they will be primarily used in this peaking and regulating capacity, as is suggested by policy documents. But I think that the point is that they will end up being used. And currently there is discussion that each time coal plants are built, that the older capacity should be retired and the overall fleet should be becoming cleaner. I don't think that we're seeing that happening yet. So I think right now it is, again, squeezing the space for China to increase its ambitions, which otherwise the rapid decline in costs for renewables and energy storage would imply that China would have room to increase its ambitions. So that's still what my takeaway is from this two sessions and the emphasis on energy security.
But if we look at it from this year, from a, I guess, a more micro perspective, should we be alarmed if we see higher curtailment rates for renewables? A, do you think there will be higher curtailment rates? And B, what do they mean?
Yeah, I do think that the curtailment rates in certain areas that are in Western China may be an issue, because the transmission system is inherently takes many more years to build out than renewables. In recent years, renewable capacity has tended to focus more on provinces in the eastern parts of China, the parts that have relatively more population, more energy demand. But now the shift towards the clean energy bases, which are connected via high voltage transmission, that does increase the risk of this lack of interconnection not being able to keep pace with renewables. Philip, what's your take on what this means for the 2030-60 goals? Do you have an opinion on the role of coal versus other energy sources?
Yeah, I'm more cautiously pessimistic because of the amount of investment in coal, another 70 gigawatts this year, coal-fired power stations, more coal mines. And that's because you build up vested interests in this capacity, whether it be the power companies, the mining companies, the people employed, the local governments. And every government in the world has to take into account powerful interests. So I think, I mean, it goes back to what Mikhail was saying, the key is the rate of growth and the nature, the structure of the economic growth. But if economic growth remains at 5% or more up to 2030, it will be difficult to peak by 2030, I think. And 2060, it gets a lot more difficult every year that they are increasing the use and deployment of coal. So everything is possible, but I am more cautiously pessimistic, particularly about the 2060 goal.
Well, thank you, Philip, and thank you, Mikhail. That's all the time we have for today. And listeners, also thank you for joining. As always, you can find a rich amount of OIES content on all aspects of energy, energy transition, and China energy on our website. And we hope that you'll tune in next time, and thank you for joining.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.